This is the first lecture of Unit 7, Component 2, which covers quality measurement and improvement. This slide shows the topics we will cover in this unit. In this first lecture, we will discuss the state of quality of care in the United States. In the following lectures, we will look at the definitions and operationalization of quality measurement and improvement. We will then look at quality measures and discuss the role of information technology and informatics in quality measurement and improvement. We will then look at the results of current approaches, discuss challenges, limitations, and ethical issues, and finally discuss quality measurement and improvement under the Stage 1 Meaningful Use Rules of the Health Information and Technology (HITECH) Act. Is healthcare quality as good as it could be in the United States? Some argue not. In the following slides, we will see examples of errors of omission, things that should be done correctly but are not done, and things that are done incorrectly. Finally, we will see that there is variation in care where there is no relationship between what is done, what it costs, and quality. What do we know about healthcare quality? Let's start by talking about errors of omission. The most well-known and widely cited study came from McGlynn and colleagues in the prestigious New England Journal of Medicine. These researchers asked adults in 12 U.S. metropolitan areas to provide access to their medical records. There were about 7,000 adults who agreed to do this, and their medical records were assessed for 30 common conditions. For each condition, they had indicators of quality of care, the right thing that should be done based on the best evidence. These were not esoteric things, but rather tests and/or treatments that are known to be the best approach for these given conditions. On average, only 54.9% of the care delivered was consistent with the best known quality. The National Committee for Quality Assurance, or the NCQA, is a healthcare quality organization that puts out annual reports on quality that look at gaps between organizations at the 90th percentile of quality and those at the average level of quality. From those gaps, they can determine a measure of avoidable deaths and avoidable medical costs. The latest analysis, published in 2009, found that there were 49,000 to 115,000 avoidable deaths and $12 billion in avoidable medical costs due to the gap between the highest quality and the average quality delivered. Other studies, such as that done by Schoen and colleagues, found that the quality of care for patients with chronic diseases is no better, and in many ways worse, in the United States than for other developed countries. Another way to look at healthcare quality is the measure of amenable mortality. This is mortality that could be prevented with timely and effective healthcare. Nolte and colleagues have done a number of analyses, the last one published in 2008, looking at how many deaths could be avoided with timely and effective healthcare. This excludes things like lifestyle factors and accidents, and instead focuses on conditions where death can be prevented with timely and effective health care. In 2008, the U.S. ranked last among 14 advanced countries that were part of this study of amenable mortality. Some may argue, nonetheless, that when you are sick in the United States, you have a better chance of surviving your illness and the quality of the care is better. That is true for some things, particularly cancer treatment. This figure comes from the New York Times and is a compilation of statistics that looks at 5-year survival rates for different conditions. The U.S. also does very well in breast cancer. But in kidney transplants, we trail most of the other advanced countries of the world. For childhood leukemia, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and colorectal cancer, the U.S. is right in the middle. So the U.S. healthcare system is not necessarily a guarantee that you are going to be treated more successfully. In addition to errors of omission, we have errors of commission. These are errors that are made in the provision of healthcare, for example, things that should not be done but that are done. This problem was brought to light by the Institute of Medicine's To Err is Human report in 2000. This report concluded that anywhere from 48,000 to 96,000 deaths in the United States could be attributable to preventable medical errors. Some argue that these numbers were too high, though the researchers of the report rebutted their critics, and others claim that it was really difficult to measure this sort of thing because it was done by reviewing hospital charts, and they do not always reveal the context in which the care was provided. There are also other analyses that give credence to the claim that significant numbers of people are dying from medical errors. One study is actually an ongoing study published each year by HealthGrades and finds comparable numbers. We also know, for example, that there are a substantial number of preventable adverse drug events that occur in elderly patients. Dan Mazes has taken the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's common list of leading causes of death and actually pasted in medical errors, showing that if the high-end number is true, medical error is actually one of the leading causes of death in the United States, higher than accidents, diabetes, and suicide. Another healthcare quality problem that received a lot of attention in the healthcare reform debate concerned variation in services. This is something that has been known for a couple of decades, and this research existed quietly before a number of advocates in 2009 started talking about it in the halls of government and the popular press. The Dartmouth Atlas Project has been around for about two decades, and it has shown substantial variation in care for many conditions across the United States. Yet despite all the variations, there was not much difference in quality. Certainly, there are few measurable outcomes that show that those who get more services have better overall outcomes. As such, the Dartmouth researchers argue that variation in chronic illness care is so substantial that reducing the level of care to the most efficient providers could reduce expenditures by 30% without any apparent change in any type of clinical outcome. Healthcare costs also vary widely across different regions in the United States, and most of the explanation is due to the behavior of physicians in terms of choosing to order tasks, to prescribe medications, and to do surgeries. This issue also came to light in the 2009 healthcare reform debate. One of the major reasons was a highly quoted and popularized article in The New Yorker by Atul Gawande that looked at variation in healthcare spending in two communities in Texas. The Dartmouth Atlas consists of graphs like this one that look at Medicare spending per beneficiary in different parts of the country. It is well known, for example, that in places like New York, Boston, Texas, and Florida, there are very high levels of spending, as opposed to places like Oregon, Wisconsin, and Utah. Yet there is no apparent difference in patient outcomes for these different levels of spending. Another well-known graph from the Dartmouth Atlas looked at the rates of coronary artery bypass surgery per Medicare enrollees. Again, there are parts of the country, particularly in the Southeast and Upper Midwest, where the rates are much higher than other parts of the country, such as Oregon, Southern California, and a few other places. Here is another Dartmouth Atlas graph of the variation in hospital beds per 1,000 residents. Again, we can see it is very high in the Southeast and much lower in the West. Some of the variation is explained by so-called supply-sensitive factors. That is, the more supply there is of something, the more it is used. So if we plot out the number of cardiologists by the number of visits to cardiologists, you see this gradually increasing line. Similarly, for the number of acute care beds plotted out against the hospital discharge rates, we see that the more discharges, the more beds. In other words, hospital admissions are related to the number of beds in a community. There tends to be more utilization of services in different settings around the United States, but there is one area where there is no variation, and that is in quality measures. This graph from Fisher's studies plotted Medicare spending measured against medical specialist visits, hospital days, and percent admitted to ICUs. Again, the more medical specialists there are, and the more hospital days there, the more spending there is. But if you look at the flat line on the bottom, it is the Effective Care Index, which is an aggregation of healthcare quality measures. That number actually stays the same, no matter what the level of spending. So more spending does not necessarily result in higher quality care. One study actually showed an inverse relationship between quality and spending. This graph contains a ranking of the states by quality, plotted against Medicare spending. And, as you can see, there are certain low-spending, high-quality states like New Hampshire, Utah, Oregon, and Hawaii. There are other states that have higher rates of spending, while they have lower quality. Now, the probable explanation for this is not so much that there is worse care developed in those states, but that the care is less coordinated, which results in reduced quality measures and increased spending. More on the theme of more is not better. We know, for example, that more care of chronic diseases is not associated with longer life or better quality of life. Another hospital-level analysis continues to support the notion that there is no or even a negative correlation between spending versus quality. There is some data that shows lower-cost hospitals have modestly lower quality care. But when you actually risk-adjust them for other factors, that difference goes away.